The assassination of President John F. Kennedy was obviously not the first assassination of an American president. It remains the presidential assassination that to this day causes questions for people. These questions are a result of the actions or maybe inactions of people who are expected to be a part of delivering the truth. And my next guest says, boy, did they fail. The core tenets, I've mentioned this before, of journalism. You remember journalism, right? They have long been who, what, when, where, why, and how. And this is how my next guest approaches the JFK assassination. He does this from a unique position as well, since he was also deputy chief counsel for the House Select Committee on Assassinations back in 1976. He's also served as assistant DA for the County of New York under the legendary Frank Hogan as a prosecutor, never lost a felony trial. He later became a best-selling author of both fiction and nonfiction. His latest nonfiction is That Day in Dallas, Lee Harvey Oswald Did Not Kill JFK, Robert K. Tannenbaum. Sir, a pleasure to have you here on the show. Congratulations on a job well done in so many ways.
Well, thank you very much. It's my honor to be with you.
Robert K. Tannenbaum Books.com to get a taste of Mr. Tannenbaum's literary world. I mentioned the title of your role in the assassination committee. Talk about what the details of that role were at least designed to be.
Well, what happened was Richard Sprague called me in October of 76. And as you know, a select committee has a life of 2 years. That is to say, they get funded initially and then they evaporate after the two-year period. So this committee was formed with Sprague being the chief counsel and staff director in the middle of October 76, and he called me up. I didn't know who he was. He was the go-to guy in Pennsylvania. If you had any serious trial work, you went to him. He was the chief assistant DA in Philadelphia, so he was Mr. Philadelphia totally, and you can throw in Pittsburgh and everything else there. He was the main guy, and he called me up. I didn't know who he was because at the time I was in charge of the Homicide Bureau, and having tried countless cases in the Homicide Bureau, that is to say, prosecuted these cases. And it turns out the only person who ever prosecuted more was Richard Sprague in Philadelphia. And he told me about himself and that he had checked me out. And I said, you know, with all due respect, I just don't know who you are and you know, why me kind of thing. And we had a good chat, and we got together, and he then asked me to take over the subcommittee investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy. And there had just been an investigation, interestingly, for Senator Schweiker, Richard Schweiker from Pennsylvania had engaged in, and it was part of what they called the Church Committee, Church being the senator. And that committee was looking into the assassinations of Kennedy, King, and Schweiker, Senator Schweiker, this conservative Republican at the time, and when I say that with all due respect to the extent that he was not some guy looking for a quick shot on the news, a 15-second thing. He was a very serious person and had a great deal of respect from both sides of the aisle. And Schweiker called me when I got to Philadelphia, when I got to Washington, in January, in early January of 77. And again, the select committee was going to go away December 31, 78. And he said he wanted to see me. So, of course, I went to see him. He told me about his ordeal, as his words, of dealing with the CIA. I had no knowledge of any of this. And again, I was in charge of the Homicide Bureau and the criminal courts when I was in Manhattan, in the Manhattan DA's office. Now, to give you some scope on that one, the criminal courts took in 250 new cases every day, if you can believe that. It was 150 new cases from the morning sessions, that is to say, from morning through to the evening to about 5 o'clock at night, and then another 100 cases from night court. We did rearranged 7 days a week, 24 hours, right through. And which is important, obviously. You don't want people sitting in jail who have been accused of crime and then have the case dismissed as soon as the DA looked at it kind of thing. It's a total abuse of what we're doing. So anyway, I sat with him, and he told me that the CIA had totally interfered with the investigation. They not only didn't participate, they obfuscated everything that was going on. They were making stories up that weren't true, and he was astounded that that would be the case. So he said he understood from my background that I'm probably sitting there in disbelief, which I was when I was listening to him. And he then said, the last thing I want to tell you is sort of gut-wrenching, and again, very difficult to take, and that is, after he gave me his notes, he said that these things about the CIA, and he said that bottom line is, from the investigation, the evidence points to the fact that the CIA participated in the assassination of the President of the United States. Well, I felt like, 10 gallons of ice water were just poured on my head.
Yeah.
And I will tell you, Sprague and I were surprised to hear something like that, to be sure, but it didn't interfere with our investigation. Our investigation, in direct answer to your question, was that we met with the committee members in Washington on the House Select Committee, and we said to them, if in any way we want a commitment from each of you that you will not interfere with this investigation, because we don't have a brief about what we're going to find one way or the other. If the facts are that Oswald did it, he did it alone or whatever, we're going to tell the American people that. If the facts are that he didn't do it, we'll tell the American people that as well. And they agreed. Well, it only took them about 3-4 months to demonstrate that they were completely insincere in that notion. And that, by that I mean to say, the evidence was overwhelming that the murder of the president was not in any way some haphazard event. It was something that the government knowingly contrived, and that was to have a predetermined conclusion through the pretense of an investigation. It was a pretense probe. And both the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee disregarded all convincing and trustworthy evidence to the contrary, particularly the Parkland doctors. Parkland doctors were missing from the evidence in this case, and they were critical in dealing, obviously, with trauma when the president was wheeled into trauma room one to do everything they could to save his life. And then they came up with phony theories, which I'll go into you for a moment.
Sure.
One was the alleged science, which was called neutron activation analysis, and that was to demonstrate that a fragment of a bullet and a fragment, fragments could match fragments, and fragments can match whole bullets. That was their theory, because they said they had now science on their team, and to the extent that neutron activation analysis proved that there was only two ballistic pieces of evidence in the case. There was the two fragments in the car, in the limo, rather, and they matched each other. And then there was fragments taken out of Connolly's right wrist, and those fragments matched the so-called magic bullet, the pristine bullet, that is Commission Exhibit 399. Well, what happened was no one at that time, because Sprague and I, once we were told basically that the committee no longer wanted to continue this investigation the way they promised, we resigned. And that was somewhere around January, February, March, April, in that area, after like 4 months. But nobody from the supporters of NAA, neutron activation analysis, the principal testing component for comparative bullet lead analysis, that again is fragment to fragment to fragment to bullet, no one bothered to speak to metallurgical PhDs. And they came out with scathing reports once they found out what the government was trying to do, and that was the CIA's probe, that they said that NAA is totally invalid. Well, now the FBI was up a very, very slippery pole, to the extent that they had already approved FBI agents going into courts under oath testifying to the legitimacy in criminal cases of NAA. And now it's turning out that the press is on the case that the CIA has maneuvered even the FBI into this embarrassing situation. They're claiming that NAA is the end-all of it all, it's science. And they were going around actually saying to CIA that now that we have NAA, anyone who doesn't believe our science must believe that the world is flat, literally saying these kinds of nonsensical things. And it turns out that what happened was the pressure was so intense on the FBI, not totally unlike things are today, by the way. It's amazing how time travels, and we wind up with the same sorts of problems, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But what happened was the FBI asked to have the 10 best people that the metallurgical PhDs believed were, and have them investigate this case on NAA. And they did. And, you know, guess what? They all came down with the notion that NAA is invalid and it should not be used at all. And our government had in Washington the only lab that was doing any of this comparative bullet lead analysis. And on September 1st, 2005, the government ordered, the FBI ordered the lab to be shut down, and the FBI directed its agents never to comment about any legitimacy coming out of NAA. So that was a major issue. And then they went into the magic bullet, and the magic bullet is another confounding silly thing, to the extent that, as you know, from the government's case has always been this: the president and Connolly were shot. There were three shots that came from the back. And those three shots, Kennedy was hit in the head, and he was hit in the back, 5-6 inches below the neckline. Now, you recall also the opening in Kennedy's neck. And the single bullet theory was that the shot that hit JFK in the back, 5-6 inches below the neckline, which was part of the autopsy report, all of which is in the book. And the question was how did that shot then wind up coming out his throat? Because that's the basis of the one bullet theory, is that this one bullet exited Kennedy's neck, struck Connolly in the back, struck his rib, and fractured the axial nerve in his wrist, and also severed the tendon between his right thumb and index finger, and remaining pristine. Even the government exhibits of having one bullet do all those different things was totally deformed in large measure, but not the pristine bullet. So the question always arose first: how did the bullet get out? If it entered his back in a downward track at 5-6 inches below the neckline. So they said, well, it came up. The bullet actually came up 11 degrees and exited the throat. Well, you know, what do I have to tell you about the lack of credibility about that one? So what the evidence was, in fact, was that during the course of this investigation, I was able to get my hands on a letter that was written by John McCone. I say letter, it could be a document, whatever, however you want to characterize it.
A memo.
And it was written in response to Chief James Rowley, who then was head of the Secret Service. And Rowley said he was concerned about leaks, because their major concern at this point after the assassination was they wanted to cover up and make sure that nobody knew that Oswald was a contract employee of the CIA and the FBI. And which he was since 1957. He was at Sugi Air Force Base monitoring U-2 flights. And you may recall that Gary Powers, one of the pilots on those U-2 flights, had his plane shot down. And the government was very concerned about that, because they only believed the mole in the government would have known how to bring one of those planes down, much less get him up. And so they had, of all people, Oswald play a role here, that he was defecting and he wanted to speak to someone who had information, because he had information about this stuff. Well, the mole never came forward. But what did happen was JFK fired Alan Dulles, who was then head of the CIA in 61 as a result of the Bay of Pigs fiasco. And Dulles remained a critic right throughout all this. But in 61, JFK hired John McCone, who was a very pro-Kennedy lawyer type person. And he said, when he got this letter from James Rowley, head of the Secret Service, worried about leaks, about Oswald's training and suspect activities, et cetera, he said he was concerned as well, because he said if any of this was disclosed to the wrong persons, it would lead the media to erroneously claim that the CIA and perhaps others were directly involved in what he called the Dallas Action. The Dallas Action is how they referred to the assassination. And then he went on to say, at the second page of this two-page letter, he said, well, while the persons involved in the assassination were in the employ of the CIA as well as the FBI, imagine this, This is an admission from the head of the CIA saying while the persons involved were in the employ of the CIA, that is involved in the assassination, as well as the FBI, it's impossible to maintain full 24-hour their responsibility over their acts. That's how they sort of justified the fact that people were going around murdering, much less the President of the United States. And so, also, I was able to get something that was interesting about Harry Truman, President Truman. By the way, the McCone letter was March 3rd, 64, in response to the James Riley issue. And President Truman, on December 22nd, 63, had major misgivings, he said, about the CIA, and that he blamed himself for permitting the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, our intel organization during World War II, to morph into the CIA, and why he wrote this out. And it's all of this is obtainable. And it's in my book. Excuse me?
And the original, I just want to point out to you, you're not just transcribed. You have photos of the original documents of the McCollum memo.
That's exactly right. It's in the book. It's all in the book. And that what Truman said was, he was very disturbed that the CIA had diverted diverted away from its original assignment, which was to get information and get it to the White House. And it has become operational. He believed it became operational, and it formed policy, which was very embarrassing to the government because it was not coming out of the White House. So those issues came popping up. And then what happened was, what really happened at Daley Plaza, in order to let you know how the investigation moved. We decided we would definitely handle this case like we did any other murder case. And Sprague was an amazing person. He was a brilliant lawyer, and he was a totally honest person. And his integrity was beyond reproach. And the truth at Daley Plaza was there weren't just three shots. And I'll explain to you why, because it's another very serious lapse in this cold case. And that is that, again, the government knowingly contrives these predetermined conclusions in order to satisfy this pretense of an investigation, because they disregarded all of the convincing evidence of the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And here's what happened. There were five shots at Daley Plaza, not three. And the five shots were disbanded in two flurries. The first flurry of shots, as it came from the witnesses, were hit Connolly and Kennedy in the back. Those were three shots. The eyewitnesses said there were two or three shots, but they didn't have the information that I had, and that was to say the information was from immutable evidence, scientific, audiovisual, and acoustics, all of which came out after many years. And so they also said that those first shots, whether two or three, turns out three, as I said, happened in 2.6 seconds. All the shooting at the crime scene was 8.3 seconds. And then they said there was a pause. That pause, it turns out, was 4.8 seconds. You see how you corroborate witnesses who are more than just, I can identify the shooter in a lineup kind of thing. They unwittingly know a lot, and you just don't pass them off. And here it is. The first shots happened quickly, 2.6 seconds. The pause, 4.8 seconds. And here's the coup de grace of the case. It was a downward track from, we know from watching this film of the assassination. Again, we've never had a film of something like this. And it was Zapruder frame 313. That was the fourth shot. It caused a boom blast. You may recall, because that boom blast came from the stockade fence area, the Knoll Hill area. And Holland and all these people who were on the bridge watching the motorcade come towards it, the motorcade was headed in a westerly direction, Kennedy sitting upright. Even after he was shot in the back, he was clenching his fist, as you recall, and he was sitting upright.
Right.
What happened was, at frame 313, we see the fourth shot, the blast. And it came from the stockade fence area, and Zapruder, to his right, is moving right towards that area. People on the grass in front of the fence, in front of the stockade fence, hit the deck, in essence. They covered up because the shots, they said, were flying over their head, and they were in the line of fire, they thought. And then what happened was the following. What we see is so critical in this case, and that is when JFK was struck in his temple above his right ear, geographically, that was from the front. It wasn't somebody standing in Elm Street filming it. It was someone on the side. It was someone on the side, that is to say, it was Zapruder was filming this, and he was on the side of and in front of JFK in the limo. And JFK, as a result of being hit in the temple area above his right ear, that caused JFK's head to violently snap back and to the left, leaving him immobile, basically bodily depressed and slumped dead, resting on his wife's right shoulder. Now, you're asking the question right now, well, how can Tannenbaum be saying that his head snapped back after being shot? The government told us that all the shots, the three shots, came from the back. But Kennedy's head snapped back. We saw that. We don't have to have the government tell us anything. How could that have happened? The reason it happened is because we saw it happen. And the reason was because of the nature of the wound that caused the fragmentation of the back of his head to be expelled. This was an avulsive wound that he now suffered from.
And you point out in your book, too, that they tried to recreate that shot so the head would snap backwards by it being shot in the back, and 10 times they tried, 10 times they failed.
That's exactly right, because what they did was they gelatinized skulls, 10 skulls that were supposed to be human, from the same height as the depository sixth-floor window, as well as the distance. And all 10 shots, the head moved forward. All shots were from the back, hit the skulls in the head. The posturing of that that was reflect human head skull, and the skulls moved forward. Now it was as if what witnesses said without hesitation that it was as if JFK got hit with a bat on the side of his head, and his head always moved with the force. So when you want to look at the films here, don't look at the body, look at his head. His head is moving his body, not his body is moving his head. And that's what happened. If JFK's head snapped back, which it did, they can say to the nth degree, and by the way, the CIA has never commented about this. They haven't said, other than their neutron activation analysis nonsense and the single bullet theory, things that people are supposed to swallow here. How can anyone believe any of that? Bullets moving upward in a body 11 degrees from a downward track. That's a good one, I'll tell you that. So then we have the truth at Dealey Plaza, but we also have here what I call minute metallic fragments. When I say it's part of the whole evidence of the case. And minute metallic fragments were the fragments taken, they're fragments taken from JFK's head at the side of his head. We know that he was struck in the right temple area and through the rear region. That's how the issue of minute metallic fragments, all of which I have again in the book in graphic detail, were, if someone were to shoot me right now in the back of my head, there would be no minute metallic fragments in the front of my head. Now, that makes sense because the minute metallic fragments, they form a gray cloud near the center of the fragment wound. And I hope everybody listening would get the, in some way, have access to the three skull x-rays. That is, everybody has access to it. You just got to be in Washington. And the three skull x-rays show this gray cloud at the center of the fragment trail. So what is the significance of this, minute metallic fragments? They say they indicate the direction of the wound and the point of entry. And that's what has shut down the CIA and this whole thing. But they just keep going forward. So for 62 years, now they were told that we got 80,000 pages. You know, it's interesting because President Trump indicated in his first term that he was going to hand over everything. He didn't do it, and someone up, people close to him said, why didn't you do it? And he said, well, if you saw what I saw in there, you wouldn't have turned it over either. Well, President Trump knows. In order to have credibility, you do that which most governments hide from the people. They don't believe for their benefit, that is people in the government's benefit, that the people can handle anything called the truth or anything near that. So then another real problem occurred in this case for the government's phony case. And that is, you know, when you're lying, you got a lot of problems, I think, that could come up. When you're telling the truth, you could tell it a lot of different ways. And what happened was, and here was the problem issue. In December of 63, the Secret Service and the FBI found that Connally and Kennedy were struck by two separate bullets, and both were shot within 1.9 seconds of each other. Well, that being the case scientifically, the manual bolt action necessary to fire separate successive shots from the alleged murder weapon, the Mannlicher-Carcano rifle, took 2.3 seconds. Then how could the Mannlicher-Carcano could not have fired both shots? Let me repeat that very quickly.
Yes.
Connally and Kennedy were struck by two separate bullets.
Right.
Both were shot within 1.9 seconds of each other. In order to do the manual bolt action to get that gun cocked, the rifle, it takes 2.3 seconds. So you couldn't get the rifle, Mannlicher-Carcano, because it takes 2.3 seconds between each shot. And Kennedy and Connally were struck between 1.9 seconds of each other. It couldn't have been the sole rifle in the case. It couldn't have taken both shots. Stace, do you understand what I just said?
It does, you know, just to borrow a line from Johnny Cochran, if it doesn't fit, you have to acquit. The time doesn't fit the claim.
You're so right. That's very well put. That's very well put. But again, if they were shot with between 1 and 9 seconds, and the rifle takes 2.3 seconds to load and reload, kind of thing, what we call the manual bolt action necessary to fire separate shots, it could have only fired one shot. Well, who fired the other shot? Interesting to note on who fired the other shot. When the Robert Shaw was a thoracic surgeon, and he went to Governor Connally's aid right away, and he was dictating into the microphone, as these doctors do. You know, you see an autopsy, the doctor is talking into a microphone. That's to say, there were observations, obviously. So if someone comes in afterwards, they'll be able to pick it up without missing a beat. And so this action was the finding, this incredible finding that I'm about to tell you, occurs in the case because, unbeknownst to Shaw, he says that there was a 27 degree downward track in Connally. From what we did, what was done was. It was determined to see from the top of the Daltex building, which has a direct view southwesterly on Elm Street. The Daltex view, unobstructed, a direct shot from the rooftop, struck Connally at a 27-degree downward track. And this is something that Robert Shaw, the doctor, did not know anything about. So let me repeat that very quickly. What the doctor said when he was treating Connally, that this was a downward track at 27 degrees in Connally's body. Thereafter, experts went up to the rooftop of the Daltex building and said that the downward track was at 27 degrees from the rooftop to the car, to the limo, on impact.
And you've diagrammed that as well with photos in your book. We have to wrap up here because, well, we ran over time, but you're saying so much of substance, but I don't want you to give everything away. I just want to wrap up by saying for you listening, you are going to be surprised by what I'm about to tell you. Mr. Tannenbaum presents all this evidence, which demonstrates just how clear and concise it is in a mere 124 pages. That's total for the book. A good part of the beginning of the book is actually motivational as far as trying to find a foundation for your life, which Robert did with people ranging from, here's a great combination, I bet you thought you'd never hear, from Lou Carnesecca to Frank Hogan and several important people in between. And again, in such a brief way, I think Robert brings about just how truth has to survive, because science and medicine, they were designed to arrive at truth. But as you'll see, and he gives analysis about the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee on Assassinations, the science and medicine were being twisted in order to create a story to get to a pre-designated ending. That they were hoping that you would believe, but thankfully, as we've seen over these ensuing years, you have not believed. But when you get a copy of That Day in Dallas, Lee Harvey Oswald did not kill JFK. The facts, the truth, the science, the medicine, they're all factually presented for you to absorb and to carry with you in discussions that you no doubt are going to have after you read That Day in Dallas. Robert K. Tannenbaum, books.com to get this and Mr. Tannenbaum's other great writing. And, sir, you have provided answers in the truth, and you have created a solution to the questions that I think so many people have been looking for and they will find in your book. Thank you for doing that, sir, for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's very important to, from my point of view, to speak on shows that have such great credibility as yours.